I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd, tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the woman who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Echler, read by singer-songwriter, actor and filmmaker Aileith McCormack. Here's Mary to tell us more about Echler.
So the Echler Urler is the subject of this story, and the Echler Urler is a character in Gaelic folklore. It's a really odd name. She's sometimes called the Echler Urler, which literally means the hostler of the floor. Or she's called sometimes the Echler Aulur. She's got various names, but she's basically a female baddie who turns up in Gaelic stories. And one of the sort of interesting ways that, certainly to me anyway, that Gaelic folklore can differ from maybe the classic versions of the great wonder tales of the world that people are maybe more familiar with, stories like Sleeping Beauty or Snow White. In Gaelic, the stepmother doesn't ever really start out wicked, but someone comes along and pours poison into her ear, and that someone is generally either the Echler Urler or another baddie called Cailleach na Cearc, which means henwife. No idea of the derivations, where these names have come from. I don't know if they're hangovers from some kind of older tradition, but anyway, they're baddies. I appreciate I'm waffling a bit, but there is a beautiful recording of the three shirts of bog cotton, which in Grimm is the three nettle shirts. But in Gaelic, the shirts are made of bog cotton. And this great storyteller from South Uist says, and then who came but the Echler Urler? I don't know who she was, but anyway, she was a bad woman. She comes along in all the stories. So along comes the Echler Urler and says to the stepmother, you won't have anything if the king dies. Children don't like you, you know. And she sort of pours all this poison into the stepmother's ear. And then she suggests to the stepmother that she could perhaps kill the children or otherwise get rid of them by magical means. And she quite often has a magic wand, and there's always these lovely repetitions. So each one of the children, one by one, goes and asks the Echler Urler for her yellow comb. And the Echler Urler taps them with her magic wand. And the next thing is they're turned into ravens. And generally she gets her comeuppance. She ends up perhaps turned into a pillar of stone with her own wand and thrown into the sea or cast out. She never wins, but obviously she's always there in all the stories. We kind of, I think, when we talked about the project very first, we were talking about the idea of kind of broader associations between women and the occult, weren't we? And we were talking about traditions relating to women and magic. And we thought it'd be really interesting to have a Gaelic story in which magic just isn't, it's not a satanic power, it's not about devil worship, and it's not seen in relation to particular models of religious belief. It just is. And Gaelic is full of traditions of otherworldly and supernatural happenings, second sight, faedrych, so prophecy. And Lauren, of course, has done that gorgeous piece of work about the Bran Seer, one of the famous Gaelic prophets.
And so I think it was just a really nice chance to kind of, again, play a little bit. She's quite like the Aethel Ruler, but she's very, very nasty. She's really proud of her magic. She kind of goes into a little bit of detail about how difficult it is and how she does it. And I think I just let rip and had loads and loads of fun imagining how a baddie with magical powers might feel.
As traditional musicians, it's probably the go-to thing for us to be inspired by the folklore side of things. It's a very obvious route to go down. And I remember those early conversations where we talked about that obviously it's in some ways much harder to write music about things that actually happened or events in that way without them being massively literal, and easier to take your inspiration from things which are so imagery based. Like everything you've just said, it's just full of this imagery that sparks off all these little artistic ideas. I think for Rachel and I, it actually felt like a massive challenge to quite doggedly say, no, we want this project to be in the large part about real women, but this part, the folkloric element, is so intrinsic to us and to where our music kind of first came from that it was so important and really fascinating to kind of look further into those belief systems and things which you skirt around, and they come into play maybe in certain lines of songs that Rachel might sing or the names of tunes that I come across in collections or whatever, but you don't get to actually sit with it all as a lot of information and delve through it and go, oh, okay, this wasn't just a little charm here or a little thing there. There was a whole belief system, and it's completely fascinating.
To do what I do, I must first find the cracks in people. A second wife, anxious, uncertain. The late Queen was so lovely, so wise, so kind. And what living woman can compete for affection with a sainted dead mother? This girl will not inherit. Any children she has will be thrown in the charity of the first wife's brats. She is easy meat for me. What if the king were to die tomorrow? I whisper. Your portion would be much smaller than the children's. She was a beauty, was she not, the queen? The daughter cannot bear that he loves another. She can't wait to be rid of you. Just wait till your husband dies, you'll see. I feel for your own children. They'll get nothing, poor babes. Almost better they were never born. Everyone has a point where they will give. With such cunning words, I twist and I prize until I find the place. And at last her heart is laid open to me. Then my power feasts. It grows heavy and coiling, and there is nothing I cannot do. For form's sake, I ask for payment. 7 granaries of oats, 7 byres of cattle, 7 folds of sheep, that sort of thing. But these are trifles, mortal wealth. All I really need is to feed my magic. Can you imagine the triumph of turning a boy into a raven? The power it takes to compress 5 feet of bone, sinew, muscle and teeth into a bird no higher than my knee? To make feathers burst through skin where none grew before, a nose curve and twist until it forms a beak, toes warp and harden into claws? It is no mean feat. The power surges upwards and outwards from my core, crackling in my fingertips, making stray strands of my hair dance in the air. Sometimes I use a wand to help channel it. It is nothing fancy, no carving, no special materials, no enchantments. I favour a simple switch of hazel. It is a pliable wood and will not crack. Sometimes I imagine I can smell it burning as the power courses through it, but it has never scorched. In any case, my nose may be confused. Magic can be a smelly business. When a large body is compressed into a small one, there can be matter left over, fluids emitted in fear. Not all of my transformations are so immediately violent. I like the long game too, the subtle tricks that play with men's minds and send women frantic. Among these are those any butcher could achieve. Slaughtering a favourite horse, say, or a bull, or a dog, and smearing its blood on a sleeping child. But I don't mind the rougher work. Sometimes a little theatre is useful. For then there is fear and anger and confusion, and my power can sate its hunger once more. It rises up, and I can work my sleeping charms, magic my poisoned combs, unleash my pet hailstones to carry a young mother to her grave. Distance is no barrier to my magic. The king's daughter may flee to Ireland with her lover or to Greece or Lochlin, but she can never outrun me. One day a box will come that bears her father's crest. She will tear it open, hungry for news of home, only to find waiting my gift of freezing death. I can tell to the minute when it has happened, for whenever a spell hits its mark, a great joy bubbles through me and I laugh until I am spent.
I think that idea of beliefs that are there to kind of explain the unexplainable, and there's a lot of that that really interests us. And we've talked a lot about the survey of Scottish witchcraft, but you know, it's a very visual thing. Sort of geographically, you see the witch trials and the cases. There were much fewer cases in the Western Isles, Northwest Highlands, things like that. And we wondered if that was partly because of this.
I think there's an element that it is. So, you know, very simply, Ireland had hardly any witchcraft cases by comparison to Scotland. The majority of them were in Protestant settler communities. There were heresy cases, and actually one of the most infamous of early Irish, what we would now recognise really as a witchcraft prosecution, the trial and execution of Pitran na Dymith, which is way back in the 1300s. That was a heresy charge. And in a sense, I think you've got a little bit of that, just a different model of belief in magic. You've got a different rollout of reformed faith. But then you've also got different administrative systems. Possibly you've got different ways of justice making. You know, if you've got a direct appeal to a clan chief for a gripe, possibly you don't feel so much need to say that your neighbour killed your pig and therefore should be executed as a witch. And in a way, we can't fundamentally say why it happened. We can talk about many of the factors that may have contributed, but you know, it didn't happen everywhere, or it happened differently. Some places, like for example, Iceland, mostly persecuted men.
And we can't 100% ever get to, you know, a correct answer. It's just a case of weighing up what we do know. And in a way, we probably freed ourselves by saying we're going to make a creative project versus, you know, we're going to write a history. But I think definitely Gildam had a different attitude. So you get stories of, you know, clan chiefs employing a witch. We talked in an earlier episode about how clans had poets who, you know, were propagandists. And actually, sometimes I see in the poetry almost a belief that, you know, you could physically harm people with your poetry. And then there's viciousness in some of the poetry. Say Ian Loam, John MacDonald, he obviously a MacDonald poet, and he writes in a poem about the Battle of Inverlochy, he writes about, you know, these Campbell hands cut off and lying on this field that's been dunged with their blood. And then, you know, you get, I say, an Alistair MacVeister, Alistair, a line that's always stayed with me is he said to another poetess who was dissing his side in whatever the dispute was, he said, Le morlich de gud varstachal fenam de lehet hietaral. So he says, with my inches of bardic satire, I will flay your skin from you. And, you know, I think there are sort of suggestions that further back in broader, well, we call it Gaelic, joint between Scotland and Ireland culture, that actually perhaps poets were seen as incredibly powerful. And so as well as having poets doing this kind of thing, some clan chiefs reportedly had witches. So MacGorim of Lochaber being one who supposedly, I think it was Cameron's, that she went out and kind of helped them settle grievances by means of, you know, dispatching her magical cats and that kind of thing. All a wee bit kind of surreal. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of just big difference between the Gaelic-speaking areas of Scotland and the rest of it. But of course, we're talking about a time that, while it's very long ago, it's a long period of time, you know, between the late 1500s and, you know, the early years of the 1700s. So you've got a lot of social change everywhere. So obviously, again, you know, it's not simple. And as we've seen, women were persecuted in many Highland communities too.
True that my power holds no bounds. It is woman's magic I have, and grown men do not often fall under my spell. Boys are fine. Although the younger they are, the better it works, and the magic may be imperfect when they're nearing their maturity. Day as raven, night as a boy, that sort of thing, it's a nuisance. Worse, though, are the girl children. They often elude me. Although perhaps that is not a weakness in the magic, but rather in my own self. I speak in the same bright tone I use with the boys. I smile the same smiles. I spin the same small endearments. There's the yellow comb over there on the dresser. And over you go, my little warrior girl, and pick it up. Hurry along now, my dear, and take the box to your stepmother. She has need of it. Your brothers, my love? I've not seen hide nor hair of them here today. It does not work. No, I have never had the gift of convincing the daughters. They seem to sense a too much in my interest in them, an unnatural brightness in my smile, perhaps a too hard glitter in my eye. Or perhaps they recognise woman's magic when they feel it. Perhaps it is of them too. Since I first recognised this, I have tried to stay away from the girls. Now I prefer to charge the stepmother with all the dealings with the family. Even the silliest chit of a girl can usually follow my orders, although often I need to repeat myself. Tell the king you'll die unless he casts his daughter aside. Tell him to make sure she's gone for good. Tell him to bring you her heart and her liver and her little finger. the daughters can still surprise me. I do not have the gift of foretelling, and I cannot always see what they will do. People are unpredictable. Part of me admires their wit. I ask myself what I would have done had my father told me my stepmother wanted him to kill me and give her my heart and my liver and my little finger as proof. I do not know if I would have been willing to cut off the dratted finger so he could give her it along with the heart and liver of a lamb. I would certainly never have said I would feel no pain because of my father's love for me. Cutting a finger off hurts. Anyone who tells you any different is lying. Besides, I wasn't that fond of my father. It is harder to swallow the fact the most recent one outsmarted the geese with which I bound her. She may not be on foot. She may not be on horseback. She may not be on the green earth. The day she tells what her stepmother and I have done, and this is a baptismal oath. How was I to foresee the damned girl would go capering around the hall of her husband's castle, balanced on the back of a boar, while she whispered the secret into the ear of the child she had specifically chosen not to baptize for that very purpose? Oh, she was a cunning one, I have to give her that. And so I begin again at the bottom of the sea, in the frankly dull form of a pillar of stone. My hazel rod still bore enough magic for them to strike me with it and turn my own gifts against me. Now I must bide my time until I rise again. Power like mine cannot be tamed forever. Queens will die. Kings will mourn. New wives will chafe against their binds. Yes. As long as there are stories to tell, and Gaelic to tell them, I will return.
I was really jealous, can I just say it, when you were recording. And I thought it was so fitting that you were recording in the view of the sea. And because you began with Lilius and they sent her for eternity to be in the sea in that way. And I was so jealous. I was thinking, oh, I wish I was there with you.
It was very special. Yeah, we were lucky to have fantastic Andy Bell working on the album with us. And he was really intrinsic to the creative process too. We recorded on Great Bernera on this kind of, I think it used to be a prawn, was it? Like a prawn packing?
Prawn packing factory.
Factory, yeah. Just sort of looking out, sort of recording and looking out onto the shore, watching boats going out and coming back. And Lauren, you spotted some wildlife, didn't you?
Yeah, I was trying to do a fiddle take and I think Rachel and Andy were in the control room and could hear me going, ah, 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 as I was trying to record the fiddle because there was an otter, or I think maybe two otters just in the bay by the pier. And these moments are kind of special when you think it's not just you there making the music. There's some other people having a listen as well, or other things having a listen. It's a special time. And I think this project would have been massively different. The outcomes would have been really different had we all met up multiple times, and maybe all those rough edges of it might have got too smooth and it would have become something a little bit too structured and become something else entirely. So yeah, if I'm grateful for any part of the madness of the last couple of years, that would be it. I think we knew when we recorded this that it was going to be the final track on the album. And as much as it's a track about your story, Mary, it also felt like it was a little bit of a closing piece. The track starts with this fiddle melody that's, I suppose, it's like an old Gaelic tune. And I had this idea to layer it up almost as if it was sung like a psalm in terms of the kind of presenter and then the delayed response from the congregation. So that was one little element of it, but I think it was also just having this quite simple melody and then this slight chaos going on in the background, which alluded to kind of the chatter of, again, slightly symbolic thing of all the gossip and words that were thrown about communities in reference to all the different trials and things. So yeah, trying to create some kind of sound world. The melody was the Gaelic thing and in reference to that point of the folklore, but the kind of arrangement idea was more to do with the overarching topic.
Yeah, and I think lyrically, you know, that it kind of transforms then into sort of a different kind of feel, doesn't it? And the harp comes in quite late into the track and then there's this bit of vocals. And again, a mixture of taking some of your words, Mary, and also going back to this charm, the counteracting the evil eye charm from the Carmina Gadelica in the between. And I think, again, like Lauren was saying, we kind of thought of this track, obviously about Echler, but also summing up the whole thing, really. And I really just loved those lines. So I begin again as stone and of the sea. Far from the place they turned my gifts against me, which I think isn't exactly what you wrote, but it was kind of taking bits of that idea of beginning again and the stone in the sea, which feels like it kind of harks back a bit to Lilius. And that idea of your gifts being turned against you, whether that be in Echler's case, that sort of magic, or whether it is just being a woman, you know, that felt like just a good line to use. And then it goes into this little section of the charm, which translates, an eye covered thee, a mouth spoke thee, a heart envied thee, a mind desired thee, which again just felt like it kind of spoke to the whole project. And then back into the English, I'll bide my time until I rise again. I'll find the cracks and break your heart open. It spoke of the kind of remembering and the rising again in our memories.
It also felt quite important, I think, for the last line there to be in the first person as well, because it wasn't speaking off somebody else. It's that, again, giving one person or perhaps many people that final word in the album. It was probably quite a pointed choice to make the last track very gentle, and it is almost like there's a small kind of like prayer or hymn element to it, that it's got a certain poise that I think is what I would hope from that is like respect and empathy. That in that way, it's much more about the whole project rather than just the one story.
I think that's really fascinating. And from my perspective, it's fascinating to think both about the way that the project ebbed and flowed, in the sense that the idea was you guys, it was your creative spark. And when you came to me, there was then a sort of funny interim liminal. We keep talking about liminal periods and liminal places. We had this moment then when only the stories existed and the music didn't exist yet. And then, of course, the music existed, so the circle comes round. But in some ways, they're so interlinked and then they're so very different. And the ways that you guys, in these conversations, the ways that I've understood that you called back and created a very much a coherent piece, which has jarring and it doesn't aim to make for a comfortable coherent piece, clearly deliberately. But I was working quite differently then, because obviously I then took the stories away and they became a book. And I wrote histories that connected them, and I chose to connect them thematically. And actually, I've seen in these conversations links between them that I hadn't thought of before. And I think I maybe said in an earlier episode, somebody said to me, why didn't you just make it a collection of short stories? And she said it felt to her like a load of doors, and you opened the door and the witch was right there, and it was like a terrible advent calendar, and you were sort of like right in. And in some ways, maybe had I done it like that, I would have spent the time looking for all of the flows through. And it's just been completely fascinating to hear how you work. And like, for me, it's been a great, really rich learning experience.
Likewise, so great to hear your process. And yeah, I think as we've said before, just we did work on this project in the depths of lockdown, and for all of us to get together finally to talk about it has been such a joy.
It's been really special.
Yeah.
So I begin again, a stone and off the sea, far from the place they turned my gifts against me.
You've been listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album, with thanks to Mary Kidd and Aileth McCormack.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.